Quick question. Are you someone who is a rule follower, no exceptions, or are you someone who really likes to find the loopholes and you say every rule must have its exceptions? Anthony's already right out. Yeah, this is true. You come over, you're like, well, I know the Bible says this, but what about this, right? Good, yeah. Who are my rule followers? It says this. This is it. Raise your hand, right, yeah. That is, okay, it's interesting. You're both. Okay, well, let's see, which way do you lean? Okay, so some of you who are rule followers, you were not very confident in that, so that's okay. You're like, yeah, I think because you're worried. What about those of you who are always looking for the exceptions to the rule? You're always, there's some people that are very proud about that. Okay, I admit, I am, yes, and yes, I see you in the balcony too. Yeah, you are always looking for I know that's how I was. When I was a kid, I drove my parents nuts because they would give me a rule and then I would always ask the question, well, what if, right? Hey, you're in trouble. You are going to stay in the house tonight. And I'm like, well, what if the house is on fire? Am I allowed to leave then, right? Mark, stop running in the street. Well, what if I walk in the street? Would that be okay? Is that fine? This one I made up, and just so you know, I wasn't that rebellious. And my parents were never that strict. Don't date that girl. Well, what if we're at a party and she and I just happen to be there together at the same time, right? That might be Anthony. So, yeah, there's always these times that we are always looking for the exceptions rather than figuring out what the rules are. Now, as we go through Deuteronomy 21, the challenge is we have, Deuteronomy's been laying out a lot of laws, and it's been hearkening back especially to the book of Leviticus, and then even also back to Exodus, all of these laws that God has been given to them. They're getting ready to go into the promised land. They're trying to set up a new society, but they don't know how to operate as a society because up until then, they were just slaves in Egypt. And then they got out and they had all these battles, but God essentially fought all the battles. So they weren't really warriors. They were builders, but they didn't know what to do in gathering together as a society and learning how to treat one another. So there's some rules that God has already laid out, rules like this. When you enter the promised land, as we studied last week, kill everybody. Now, that one's a tough one, right? We hear that and we're like, that's very jarring to our ears. But what's really fascinating is 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks ago, this exact topic came up, saying, when you enter the land, wipe out everyone. And then right after that, God says, and whatever you do, don't marry any foreigner. And I even pointed out, like, well, that seems like an odd thing, because if everyone's dead, then of course, we're not going to marry a captive. We don't even have any captive women. And the idea behind this is God knows who we are, right? But God gives us a rule, and he knows we're going to mess up on this. So here's the rule. Don't kill everyone, and whatever you do, don't marry captive women. He also has given the rule in the law that says don't have more than one wife, right? That's kind of a good rule. That's a good rule. And whatever you do, don't murder people, okay? Don't murder. There's all these strange laws, and it seems as if Deuteronomy 21 is almost this whole discussion on the what ifs, on the exceptions. Becca?
Two questions.
How are we feeling about what? Oh, yeah, the malicious compliance, I won't get into that. That's more of just our rebellious spirit, that whenever we get a rule, we're trying to always, like, find the loophole. And second of all, when I use the word foreigner, it's not in reference to a right to a land. It is just simply the ethnicity of the Jewish people. God said, you will be marrying within your own ethnicity, not because they thought the ethnicities of others was in and of itself bad. It was just, you are setting up a brand new society, and God knows that the moment they start intermarrying, as Vicar talked about last week, Solomon ended up with 300 wives and 700 porcupines, and all of those concubines, and all of those, then what ended up happening to Solomon? He strayed horribly. And that was because of all of the, God knows that if we have the chance to fall away, especially when it comes to the idea of marriage, our salvation is so important. It is the most important thing that God will do whatever it takes to protect. So we, again, we get these laws, and I know that some of these laws are really hard to listen to. But then we get into chapter 21 and we get some other really funky, like, well, what about this? So here's chapter 21. We're going to talk about what to do if someone is killed, but we can't find the killer. Now, we know that if someone kills and kills maliciously, then that person is to die. But if someone accidentally kills, then they may flee to the city of refuge. Remember all that, that kind of talk? So the idea of you know, was it accidental or was it premeditated? So here is this interesting story, interesting what if about unsolved murders. If a man is found slain, lying in a field in the land the Lord your God has given you to possess, and it is not known who killed him, your elders and judges shall go out and measure the distance from the body to the neighboring towns. Then the elders of the town nearest the body shall take a heifer that has never been worked and has never worn a yoke, and lead her down to a valley that has not been plowed or planted and where there's a flowing stream. There in the valley, they are to break the heifer's neck. So this is one of those things, as we go through this particular thing, note this. To God, all life is precious. All life. And if someone ends up murdered, and no one comes forth and confesses, or no one saw it. It was the perfect murder. They got away with it. The elders and the judges, which is interesting, there's a group that's not with them at this point. I think they show up a little bit later, and that is the priests. So the elders and the judges, these would be the leaders of the civic authority there in the towns. They're the ones that say, hey, having someone being murdered is really bad, and we can't have this happen. And life is so precious that if someone took this person's life, another life must be taken. Usually they would be looking for the murderer, but if they can't find the murderer, there is this mechanism. The elders would go out, they would measure the distance between where the body was found and the nearest town. And whenever they found the nearest town was then responsible, not for the death of the person, but responsible for seeking God and taking a level of responsibility that says, this person died, and so now an animal must die on this person's behalf. We think about it now, if you ever talk with people who have had murder in their family, it's obviously, it's a very devastating thing. And especially if something has been unsolved or murder has not been brought to justice, it usually becomes something that is all-consuming. I remember talking with a lady who had this, who was her son, who was murdered. She believed it was her ex-husband that did the murder, but nothing could be proved. No judge would sign off on stuff. The DA didn't prosecute. And it was so bad that, and she was so despondent. She did live for many years, but then she went ahead and attempted suicide. That's how so we understand for people needing some level of closure, even though the people in the town technically didn't do this. Now, what does this do for our lives? I think this is important. Have you ever met someone? This happens all the time. People come to me and they tell me something bad has happened. I was sexually assaulted. I had my father disown me. My child is completely wayward and gone. And you can hear the pain in their voice. I just got told to me that my husband wants a divorce. These are all very painful things. And almost instinctually, I think God builds it into us, almost instinctually when I hear that, do you want to know what the first words out of my mouth usually are? I'm sorry that happened. Now, almost always, not every time, but almost always the response back is the same. Why are you sorry? You didn't do it. Yet God has built into us this level of community that if someone is hurting, the depth of empathy we should have for them is to try to let them know that someone understands the pain that they're going through and that someone says they're sorry. It's amazing how after talking with them, and they would talk to me back, and they're like, yeah, at first I was like, why are you saying I'm sorry? But after hearing that from me, they almost feel better about it. Does that happen in your life? Have you ever said something to someone else, and they said they were sorry even though they didn't do it? You felt better. This is what God is kind of laying out. God wants all of us, as we live in community, to not just look at hurting people and go, sorry, yeah, stinks to be you. Instead, God wants us to wrap ourselves around them, cover them with community, and actually do something about it. And that's what this rite of passage actually does. They take this animal and they kill it. Verse 5, and then the priest, they finally show up. The sons of Levi shall step forward, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister and pronounce blessings in the name of the Lord and to decide all cases of dispute and assault. Then all the elders of the town nearest the body shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley, and they shall declare, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it done. Accept this atonement for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, O Lord, and do not hold your people guilty of the blood of an innocent man. And the bloodshed will be atoned for. So you'll purge from yourselves the guilt of shedding innocent blood, since you have done what is right in the eyes of the Lord. Now this, of course, hearkens to another person who did wash their hands as he was presiding over a murder trial, a guy by the name of Pontius Pilate. Yet absolutely nothing from this Old Testament rite fits. Did Pontius Pilate have the ability, the authority to release Jesus? Oh, absolutely. But he didn't. And what he was trying to do was preempt the guilt that he was going to feel by washing his hands and saying, I'm innocent of this man's blood. No, my friend, you are very much guilty of this man's blood. You very much have the power and authority to do something. That is not what this is talking about. This is not supposed to assuage your guilt over something that you have done where you just go, well, I tried. I washed my hands. I'm good. No, there's an animal died. An animal had to be killed because a person died. And so these people, realizing how precious these people's lives are, ends up having to kill an animal that had suffered, that had done nothing wrong, and they had to break the neck and then wash in the stream, saying, God, we don't know who did it, but we know that you are someone who loves and forgives and is gracious. In all of these, except for one story, in all of these stories, there's this level of graciousness that God is trying to point out in this. Someone in some town somewhere got away with murder. And they evaded the elders, the judges, and the priests. But as we all know, there's one judge that will not be evaded, and that will be God. Now, again, is that a sin that can be forgiven? Absolutely. I think this is one of those challenges we all have. We commit sins and we think to ourselves, God's not going to forgive this one. Returning back to God, confessing your sins, you will always, always receive the forgiveness of sins. So that's what we do with an unsolved murder. Again, tough for us to go like, how does this affect our lives? I'm hoping for you that when you encounter people that are going through some real struggles and real difficulties, that you show empathy and even maybe say the words, I'm sorry. I try to do this as much as I can because I understand that for a lot of people, churches are a place and a source of a lot of pain. And people go, well, I've been hurt at the hands of maybe a pastor or a judgmental parishioner. And I'm always trying to make sure that you know on behalf of all pastors and all churches everywhere, I'm sorry that that happened to you. It shouldn't have happened to you. You should have received some level of grace and love and mercy. And maybe you didn't receive anything that but just anger and hatred. And I want you to know that that's how God also wants you to know is coming to him always, grace abounds. All right, so now we get to this next story. And on mine it says under the heading, marrying a captive woman, which of course, this is all sorts of problems right from the get-go. One, they're all supposed to be dead. Two, they're told don't intermarry foreign wives. And there's some Israelite somewhere is like, but wait, what if, like, she's really pretty? What if, like, I really love her? And God, in his goodness and his graciousness, realizes that you and I tend to not follow his laws, sets stuff up so that we don't go down an even worse rabbit hole. Let me see if I can illustrate this for you. Sometimes my wife and I, we go on a diet. It's called keto diet, right, where you don't get any carbs, you don't get any sugars, you don't get any joy in your life. It's just miserable, right? And it's always funny because every now and then we'll go off the diet. And that just happened recently because we were going to be going to a wedding in Utah and then going out to Jacksonville Beach, Florida. And like, I don't know if they have keto-friendly stuff in Jacksonville Beach. They have alligator. I think that's on the keto diet. And we're like, no, we're going to go and have some fun. So I remember vividly the night Heather and I were like, okay, you know what? We're going to go off the diet. And we had a bag of kettle corn popcorn. Yum. Oh, it's so delicious. So, you know, we're like, hey, let's have some pop. So I pour a bowl of popcorn. And have you ever seen, like, dogs when they attack their food and, like, it's flying everywhere? Right? Yeah. You know, it's like when you go to the Mexican restaurant and they put the chips and salsa in front of you, like, right? So that, I ate all the popcorn. I'm like, oh, that was good. So guess what I did? Well, I filled it up again, of course. I still had like 7/8 of a bag. So I poured it again, like, and I keep doing this. The idea behind it is to not like, you know, if you break your diet, like if you eat an Oreo cookie, right? God says, or, you know, dietitians say, okay, you ate an Oreo cookie. That shouldn't mean then you then eat the entire sleeve, right? Because that's what I do. You give me one cookie, I'm going to eat the whole sleeve. Right? Here, God is saying, you know what? You might end up choosing to do something that is not good, that then shouldn't cause you to spiral out of control and go down a path that is absolutely horrible. Maybe you had a bad day and you end up at a party and you drink too much. Well, then, the option and the opportunity is I can continue on sinning. I'm drunk anyway, so I might as well do that. Or you are at work and your boss has trusted you with the money, and so you take a little bit of the money, and then you realize, well, I've already taken some money, so I might as well take even more money. That is our tendency. And God says, hey, let's stop here for a moment. Let's say something happens and there is a pretty girl. God puts these things into protection for the female. Listen to what he says. When you go to war against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands and you take captives, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman, like she's so pretty, and are attracted to her, you may take her. Now, this gets repeated frequently. You may take her as your wife. Not a plaything, not a slave, not a I can do whatever I want whenever I want. You may take her as a wife. Bring her into your home, have her shave her head, trim her nails, and put aside the clothes she was wearing when captured. And we read that, we're like, that doesn't make any sense. Why trim the nails and shave the head? And thankfully, God helps us with what it is. After she has lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, then you may go to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. So the idea is either A, she's mourned her family because maybe her family was left alive in the capturing and yet they're separated now, or her mother and father passed away and were killed in the war, and then she needs a chance to mourn. Now, this is important because you cannot treat them in this property way. You don't take the woman and say, I'll do whatever I want. You must allow her to mourn. You must give her time. And now there's also not this, I don't know, heat of the moment, like, wow, she's pretty, I just want to do whatever I want. No, you're going to have to sit for a full month. And it even, I know it softens it in the English, but you shall not go to her. That means you shall not engage in sexual activity with her. So while you're sitting around waiting, you're not supposed to just go, wow, she's going to be mine soon, so I'll treat her as a sexual object. No, you need to treat her with goods. This also happens later on. We read the story of a woman named Ruth, and what's happening is Ruth is a Moabitess, and she ends up with her mother-in-law and ends up in a foreign land. And then Ruth and her sister, Orpah, and yes, that's where Oprah Winfrey got her name. It's actually a true story. I think I've mentioned this. Oprah, that her parents misspelled Orpah. So it was supposed to be Oprah, Orpah, but so she's called Oprah. So the sister, and the sister's like, peace out, I'm leaving. And the mother-in-law, Naomi's like, Ruth, you should head on out. And Ruth says something really amazing. Where you go, I go. Where you live, I live. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and I will be buried there, and may nothing but death separate us. It's this beautiful thing, a daughter-in-law to her mother-in-law, and the husband's gone, and she's a foreigner, and the idea is God says if someone wishes to come into the family of God, and to be a part of it, then this is acceptable. Again, it's sometimes difficult because it sounds very ethnocentric, but God is always, even through the time of the Passover, all of these people, as they were leaving Egypt, God had said, if there are Egyptians that want to go with you and be a part of your community, you let them. There's always this option. You may come and be a part of this wonderful life. And this then is supposed to be to protect this woman because she doesn't have much protection. And then what happens if after you've been married for a little while and maybe you're like, I don't like the foreign wife no more. I think I'm going to dump her. Well, this is a problem, right? This was actually a problem throughout all of history, especially back in those days. If you were a wife and then you ended up with a divorce, you were always in trouble because you were used goods. No one would want you. You would end up becoming almost a ward of the church. And God said, you must make sure and take care of these people and don't abuse them and use them. And this is what he says for if you end up like not wanting to be with her. Verse 14, if you are not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes. You must not sell her or treat her as a slave since you have dishonored her. So if you don't like her anymore, you're not allowed to go, well, you're mine already, so I might as well treat you bad. There's this idea of the sanctity of life in this taking care, especially of those who cannot take care of themselves. That's why God constantly calls himself, I'm the God of the fatherless. I'm the God of the widows. I'm the God of the orphans, to make sure that we are always looking out for those people. Yeah, Kim? Yes, this would be a consent of the bride type thing. Yeah, if she was like, I'm not going to be a part of this. Yeah, there's also actually a hint in whenever she wishes, if you are not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes. The concept of that even includes if she bore you some children, guess who the children are going with? Going with mom. And so there is this sense that the woman is also part of this concept, because she is also changing her religion at that point. So yeah, it's not forced. If it was forced, then it would be not acceptable. So yeah, this would be some, just like Ruth. Ruth married as a Moabitess, married an Israelite, and then voluntarily said, no, I am no longer a Moabitess. I am now an Israeli. Then we get to this next one. I love the first opening line. If a man has two wives, well, all right. Now, I will say I did chuckle. I read a bunch of commentaries. One of the commentaries was really hilarious. The guy said this, in the Old Testament, there doesn't seem to be a punishment for polygamy. Like if you have two wives, there's no punishment listed in Scripture. And the guy said, maybe polygamy itself is the punishment. And I kind of think, yeah, this is. Now, there are a couple of things. First of all, I don't think so, but it could also be translated more like if a man has a second wife, i.e., first wife died or left, and then the man has a second wife. It technically could be, but I don't think this is what it's talking about. Now, so does the Bible support polygamy? No, the Bible does not support polygamy. It says that it happens. And it's not saying it's a good thing either. In fact, I think it's in the next chapter, the chapter after that, I love, a pastor pointed this out. He said, hey, do not bring wages of a prostitute into the house of the Lord and offer it to God. So does God like it when we hook up with hookers? No, it's the same thing. He knows you and I are a bunch of idiots, and we often choose and do things that are really wrong. And when we choose those things and do them wrong, he doesn't want us to keep going down that path and essentially throw our entire life away, because our hearts end up getting harder and harder and harder. And then we start rejecting what God is saying altogether. So every time we sin and mess up, he's always saying, come back. Even if this even happens a little bit later on in the history. They've gone out and they've married a bunch of foreign women, and then they come back in the land and there's this revival and they're like, wait a second, God told us not to marry foreign women, so I think we should divorce them all. And God says in Malachi, no, I hate to, yeah, you made a mistake. Don't make another mistake and do something stupid on top of that. Yes, Becca? Bad stuff happens when polygamy happens. Right, yeah, you're talking Abraham. Yeah, so Abraham has his wife, Sarai, and you're gonna get pregnant, and she's like, I'm 99 years old. Hey, I've got this housemaid. Why don't you hook up with her? And then God's like, what do you, no. Yeah, don't, thank you. Yeah, don't talk about Hagar, that's horrible. All the young people are like, I don't understand that joke. Hagar the Horrible was a comic strip about, he was like a Viking, right? He was like a, yeah. Google it. You'll find it hilarious. Yes, all the times that we see these, Solomon, again, a great example. Every time we see polygamy listed in the Bible, it's not a good thing. God understands that we are stupid. I mean, out of curiosity, does this happen today? It was very, I was having some great conversations with a vicar. We were chatting about this particular text. He goes, yeah, I wonder if maybe the Mormon church is going to resurrect polygamy because it really doesn't happen. And I said, well, actually, it does happen. There's, is there a TV? Don't, I don't want to watch it. Wait, are you serious? What is it called? This is Sister Wives? Does it work out? No! Right. This is no joke. I've had questions on this where a husband and a wife decide to pick up someone else. Do we even have a term for it? It's a throuple. This is not a joke. Like, I literally actually just had to do a ton of research on this to help a family out on this particular topic. Why? Because we are all looking for loopholes, right? And the guy was like, well, if my wife agrees to it, then we can bring a third person in. No! Women! No, no, no. Just say no. Guys, just say no. I'm sorry. That is dishonorable in every possible way. This is a problem. So it is, I find it interesting that we end up talking about stuff like this because people ask the question. It happens on other things too. I had a question, I was giving some premarital counseling to a couple and they asked about pornography. And I'm like, well, what about it? They're like, is that acceptable to help ourselves out? And I'm like, No, I do not support that in any way, shape, or form. And then the question, but what if both of us like it and we both want to do that? No. Even if you want, like, no. That we're always looking for the loophole. How can we maybe get around this? Well, maybe if everyone agrees to it. The answer is no. And this is where, in this particular thing, I actually do believe it is supposed to be, this is a polygamous situation. Again, if not, I think all the rules would still apply. If a man has two wives, and he loves one but not the other, and both bear him sons, but the firstborn is the son of the wife he does not love, when he wills the property to his sons, he must not give the rights of the firstborn to the son of the wife he loves in preference to his actual firstborn son, the son of the wife he does not love. I know that sounds, guy has two wives, he likes one more than the other. Don't ask me why, but this actually was in scripture, right? Jacob had two wives, and he preferred one over the other, but the one he preferred wasn't bearing any children, but the one he didn't prefer was bearing lots of kids. And the temptation is, once the preferred wife popped out a kid, I'm going to treat that one as my firstborn. And God says, no, that's not how it works. You don't mistreat children. If you're an idiot and you make poor choices, you don't make your kids pay the price. Right? Would we agree with that statement? Yeah. That God is making sure that we don't just pick and choose. And if we've done something stupid like ending up in a polyamorous situation, God says, hey, don't keep going down that path. Chuck it. Yes, Becca. Yeah, I have to admit, the question was, what happens if someone is widowed? Right, yeah, and we would say the same nowadays, right? Like if Heather dies and I find someone and I get married and that person pops out a kid, I can't go around going, well, you know, Mark Thomas, it was great knowing you. Sorry, Jacob. Sorry, Josh. I like this other person better and I'm going to pour out. No. You would still honor and love the children that God has given to you, even if you don't like the woman that bore your children. You don't punish children on that behalf. So you make sure that the rights of the firstborn, verse 17, he must acknowledge the son of his unloved wife as his firstborn by giving him a double share of all he has. That son is the first son, sign of the father's strength. The right of the firstborn belongs to him. All right, now, right about now, I'm wondering if any of our parents are sitting around going, what in the world is Heather teaching down in kids' church today? I'm just going to let you know it's this next section. What is the heading? A rebellious son. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother and will not listen to them when they discipline him, his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders at the gate of the town. They shall say to the elders, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a profligate and a drunkard. Then all the men of the town shall stone him to death. You must purge the evil from among you. All Israel will hear of it and be afraid. So if you have kids, congratulations. They're going to come back very obedient. I'm actually very kidding. Heather's like, Mark, this chapter stinks. And I'm like, oh, yeah. She's like, what do I do? I go like, well, it is Labor Day, Labor Day week. She's like, yes, I will do a Labor Day thing. So your kids will all learn. But I thought this was interesting. What do you think about this? It's so interesting with all of these things. There's always this kind of element of mercy, element of mercy, element of mercy in this. If your kid's rebellious and doesn't do what's right, just take him to the elders and they'll kill him. Do you like this passage? Well, no, I don't know. I mean, the guy might be an elder, but yeah, if I have a rebellious son, like, you know, let's say he just graduated college and he's just laying around, he doesn't have a job. That's not Joshua, right? Or they just keep going back to school over and over and over and over and over and over again. I'm not thinking of anyone in specific, but no, you end up like, hey, just get, now. Question, out of curiosity, do we have any Old Testament stories or even New Testament stories where this was even done? Jacob and Esau, but that wasn't one where, like, they took him to the gate and killed him. Oh, yeah, that one is showing the favoritism. It's interesting because God, the idea behind this is God says, does God think that the family is important? Oh my goodness, the family is super important. This is really, really, and trying to make sure and help kids understand. And I get it. When you're young, right, your parents are stupid. I get it. I thought the same thing. My dad was an idiot. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, like within a year, he became one of the smartest men I actually knew. Like, how did he learn so much in just that year? we often think about that stuff, but God says authority, parenthood, structures, these are all very important. And if someone is, and in this particular case, he is so bad, he is incorrigible, and who has to agree to this? Dad and mom. So like, mom's like, because sometimes dad's like, you know, angry and upset and he's gonna punish, and mom's like, no, that's my baby. This would be that mom is like, oh man, this kid is terrible. Now, there was something that might have gotten a little bit close to this, but it was never actually enacted. And there was this priest, and this priest had two sons, and these two sons were bad. They were taking offerings away from God, essentially stealing from God. They were hooking up with all of the women in the town at the temple. Right, so the equivalent, like bringing them to church and having sex with them in the church, and everyone knew about it. And what did dad do about it? Nothing. He was an enabler. This is also really interesting because I think this should help us understand a little bit more about a story that was told about a son who came to his dad and said, I wish you were dead. So, I don't like you. I don't want to be here. Give me my inheritance and I'm going to take off. And he does. He heads to Las Vegas, spends all his money on wild women, because they're all in Las Vegas. He spends all his money drinking, partying. And the hard part, too, is this son, there's another son, there's a brother. And what does the other brother do? The other brother's a good guy. Dad, I love you. Right? I'm your favorite, right? Yeah. And the brother stays with them and helps them plow the fields and helps them raise the animals. And this brother's sticking around. And then what does the father do? The father is constantly looking down the road, hoping and praying that his son would return. Now, some have said, I don't know if I buy it. I throw it out there as an interpretation, that when the father saw the prodigal son from a distance, he ran to him for the sole purpose of protecting him, because if the elders and the judges at the gate saw him, they might have killed him because he was a wayward son and is deserving of death. And God says over and over again, you are deserving of death, but I love you so much. And there's this really, if you want to look at it, Hosea chapter 11, we won't turn to it, but it's got this really incredible part where God is lamenting. He's like, my kids are so far gone. What is wrong with my children? They are incorrigible. They are deserving of death. And he's wrestling with this concept. And then at the end of the chapter, he says, but they're my children and I love them. And I will forgive them. It's interesting that this is in here because it helps us understand societal norms and the importance of family and structure and all that. But when you think of the love of the father in the story of the prodigal son, that should cause us all to weep and mourn, because you and I are incorrigible. We do not do what's right. We break all these rules. We keep finding all of these loopholes. And God says, and I love you, I'm going to run to you. You return back, I want to protect you. I want to help you. I want to be there for you. If you have chosen stuff that is bad, God says, okay, I don't like it. Let's don't stack on to that. Let's not do anything more to add to this. You are my child, come back. And let me tell you, it's amazing. Every time we return to God, I've said this before, every time, he says, I love you and I forgive you. Don't remain in the sin anymore. And that's why then the last part, it's very interesting, actually gets quoted in Galatians chapter 3. If a man guilty of a capital offense is put to death and the body is hung on a tree, you must not leave his body on the tree overnight. Be sure to bury him that same day, because anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. You must not desecrate the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. God is trying to help, first of all, protect the land. One of the reasons why he wants to protect the land is because he's living with us. God lives with us. God dwells with us. God is a part of us. And he even says, if someone is convicted of a capital offense and you have to then hang them on a tree, you've executed them, and now you're going to put the body up for people to see as a deterrent, whatever you do, that was still someone's son. It could be someone's father. It could be someone's brother. Do not leave that overnight, lest the animals come and pick at it and take it out. You bury that body. Even for the guilty, God says, show mercy. Jeff? Yeah. I mean, that's the reason why Galatians 3 says Jesus was under God's curse. Because, and it actually then quotes this specific passage, cursed is the one who hangs on a tree. And that's, again, the crazy part of this. This is a foreshadowing of Jesus Christ. The fact that here was this man who was convicted of a capital crime, even though he was innocent. And he was under God's curse. As we know, all of the sins of the world were laid upon him. And then they quickly took him down because they could not leave his body up on the cross. He was already under God's curse, and now he must be buried. And through that, we receive the full and complete forgiveness of sins. Becca?
What if they were like, oh, okay, we'll just hang him over, like put his robe around his neck, hang him over the side of a building, does that still like count, or is it not?
Great. See, thank you so much for approving my thing of, well, what if this? Well, what about this, right? This happens to me all the time. Every time I always love doing like stuff on baptism. The number one question I always get on baptism is, well, what if I'm out in the middle of the Sahara Desert and I'm talking with my friend and they become a Christian, but we have no water because we're in the desert? That is the thing they always ask. Can I spit on them? No, please don't spit on them. That's disgusting and gross. And I also have evidence of not to do that because there was another person who was guilty of a capital offense and came to faith in the man named Jesus Christ. And Jesus, hanging on the cross next to him, did not lean over and say, I baptize you in the name of the Father, and of me, and of the Holy Spirit. No, don't spit on them, please. Yeah, we love the what if question. I have no, some of these you're gonna get into a lot of these. The idea behind all of this is God, these are tough laws for us to hear from a society that was a much different society than what we live in here. But make no mistake about this, it all points to Jesus, who willingly gave up his life, who willingly paid the price of sin, who was the heifer whose neck was broken, who was the favored son, the only begotten son of the Father, who was the one that was murdered and then was hung on a tree. And he's the one that points us to this loving Father that runs down the road to save us and to love us and forgive us. So if you are trapped in sin, if you're doing stuff you know you shouldn't be doing, God says, hey, let's start over again. Don't keep going down that path. Let's try something new. And if you ever think that you are too far gone, you'll have to be more far gone than the prodigal son, deserving of death, and you're not there yet. Return to God. He loves you and wants to be with you.